Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. American unionism has been in serious decline for the past several decades. Today we talk with the National Union President about the challenges and issues facing his constituency. This past weekend, the Southern Conference of the American Federation of Musicians was held in Tulsa, and I spoke with Raymond Hare, the International President of the Musicians Union, who represents musicians in the United States and Canada. Now, in the spirit of full disclosure, I should mention I've been a 33-year member of the Musicians Union. And musicians have not been immune to the effects of globalization like other unions, with recording jobs being offshored to cheaper locales in Asia and Europe. American symphonies are facing cutbacks all around the country and labor difficulties as a result. And there have been incredible technological changes that have made it easier to replace live musicians with recordings. Hare has fought for musicians, first for many years as the president of the Dallas-Fort Worth local, where he was an active musician, and since 2010 as the international president. And during his tenure, the union has seen performance rights enacted for digital streaming and a new agreement with recording companies to return funds to local communities for free local performances around the country. Ray Hare was a part of the meetings at the Southern Conference this past weekend in Tulsa, and I spoke with him while he was here. Ray Hare, thanks very much for joining us. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Rich.
Yeah, the last couple decades have been pretty tough for American unions in just about every field. You have membership dropping, loss of influence in political discourse, right-to-work legislation in many states, including here in Oklahoma and your native Texas. What do you attribute all these rollbacks in unionism to?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things. Of course, we know that unionism or union density in the United States is down to single digits. It's higher in the public sector, but in the private sector, it's gone way down. There are a lot of factors there. The economic attitudes of the employers. The employers have had the benefit of National Labor Relations Board decisions that have been adverse to the worker, that have adversely impacted the organizing process. And organizing is where the lifeblood of a union is, to be able to get workers to stand together and stand up to the employer and put pressure on the employer to do things that the employees want. And that's always more difficult when you have elected leaders whose interests are more aligned with the rich 1% than they are with the average employee, the average worker.
What are the detriments to organizing? I would think for the American Federation of Musicians, especially, this is difficult because you don't, outside of like Los Angeles and New York and a couple other major entertainment centers, you don't have a big, huge business. A lot of times it's a lot of small business and small employers.
Well, you know, there's a lot of different aspects to the music business. The music business is everything from the neighborhood bar where the band plays, to the theater downtown where the Broadway shows come through, in the major entertainment centers, you know, it's the recording business, it's television, it's the film business in Los Angeles, the jingle business in Chicago, in Dallas, in L.A. and in New York. But in every one of these situations, it's funny, people have to have music, and how the public consumes music has been a factor in how we organize, and it's more difficult to organize in a way now than it used to be, because in the old days, a recording studio was a building that had to be outfitted with, you know, very expensive equipment that, you know, and you knew when a session was going on, and you knew that if, you know, a session was happening that you needed to organize, you knew where to go and who was on it and who the employers were. That's not the same way the business is being done today.
Recording studio can be a living room.
Recording studio can be a laptop and an instrument being, you know, recorded that way and then immediately uploaded to the internet, or then the file, you know, created and transferred anywhere around the world. So organizing is different now than it was, but there's a lot more entertainment now than there was. And I'll just take one example. When I arrived in this office, when I was elected as the international president back in 2010, there were a number of agreements that the AFM had that were open, that were yet to be renegotiated with employers. One of them was the live television agreement. That's the agreement that we have with NBC, ABC, CBS. And it also serves as the template for all the other live television that is done. And, you know, live television in the United States can't just jump up and run overseas. It can't just jump up and hide somewhere. Live television. And, you know, let's just say Saturday Night Live,
and I'm trying to think of what would be the other one.
Exactly. Well, the Letterman Show and all the late night shows.
So even the ones that are taped are considered live television.
Yeah, American Idol, Dancing with the Stars, all these. And that kind of entertainment has grown and grown and grown. It's sort of like reality musical television in a way. And so, you know, but that agreement was open. And so what we did something different. You know, we just didn't sit down at the table and bargain hard at the table. We went out one day, one Tuesday. We picked a Tuesday, and we leafleted every show. We leafleted the audience, and we let the audience know there was a dispute going on with the networks, that the musicians had not had a raise in a number of years, and that we were seeking raises and, you know, better health care, better health contributions, more pension, better residuals, and also new things to pay us for when the program moves over to the internet. And, you know, that was one example of how the union came together, how our members in that sector came together and engaged in concerted activity, and it made a difference. And we were able to close that agreement. We got good raises, and we got our needs met money-wise when those programs move over to the internet. So, you know, it's really about motivating members of the union to sit down and identify, articulate, and prioritize their needs, and then through the union, coming together to develop plans of action to address those needs.
Now, you've had some setbacks, though, on that. I was thinking, you mentioned Dancing with the Stars. I think Dancing with the Stars really sort of gutted their orchestra.
Well, you know, we broke that story to the press. It, you know, went out on my Facebook page and then transferred over to so many other things. It hit the wires, and there were 125,000 hits on that story. And, you know, so we were, the AFM was in charge of the press there on that issue for about a week. I got a hold of the networks, and I said, you know, look, this is not something we want to see. You know, we don't want to see, you know, I mean, we think that, you know, on Dancing with the Stars, live music is an integral part of the show, and we don't think you can have the same show with a small group and augment that with, you know, pre-existing recordings. Well, we had an effect on them, because what happened was that the band that was hired to come in, the band leader, Ray Chu, came in, and he did not have a small band. He had a large band. And what we did was create the atmosphere that made it impossible for the network to do what they intended to do.
Which is to lower their costs by lowering the number of musicians involved.
Right, to change the show format with, you know, from live music to, you know, the major part of the show being live music to being a smaller part, and then to, have them dance to tracks. So we bent the situation there, and that was a good thing.
Yeah.
We also are in a big campaign right now. The campaign's called Listen Up, and the Listen Up campaign is about how the U.S. film industry is offshoring the recording of film soundtracks to foreign countries, paid for by U.S. taxpayers.
Now, that's because you're saying, I want to be sure that we're clear here, that the film companies are often subsidized by taxpayers in various states. Say when August Osage County films in Oklahoma, the film commission grants generous tax rebates. That's where the taxpayer dollars comes in the filming of the film, right?
That's one of the places.
Yeah.
There's also federal tax dollars. Mm. And so the film companies follow the money. You know, they move their productions around from state to state to pick up large sums of money. In one case, in Lionsgate's case, and we're zeroing in on Lionsgate particularly, in the making of some uniquely American movies like The Hunger Games, where they spent $100,000 in Georgia and picked up a $20,000 check, and then they took that $20,000 and ran to Europe and had it scored, you know, in the UK, where instead of contributing pension dollars to our pension fund to take care of our musicians, and instead of, you know, contributing health care dollars to our musicians here, they go to Europe, where health care is subsidized, where pensions are subsidized, and they buy the talent on a discount there because the UK gives them tax credits as well. And so, you know, we find ourselves, you know, in a situation where the governments of the world are subsidizing, you know, corporate welfare, or, you know, adding to the bottom line of rich corporations. And then those rich corporations use that government money, the government dole, the public taxpayer dollars, to run all over the world and find the cheapest way to record music.
I imagine every union in the AFL-CIO can tell you similar stories like that, not necessarily with the tax dollars, but the idea that this is a global economy and businesses go where the labor is the cheapest. Does your union have to react to that? Or,
well, those same AFL-CIO unions won't tell you, because they can't, that the state governments are giving the corporations money to go overseas to do the scores, you know, to do mm-hmm. their work. And in this situation, there are 45 states in the United States who have film tax credit programs. And these are programs where, I'll be specific, the movie 42.
Well, Jackie Robinson. Right?
Jackie Robinson, mm-hmm. you know. The movie 42 was filmed in Georgia. It was also filmed in Alabama. And it was filmed in those two states so that the film company, and that was Legendary Pictures, you know, which was distributed by Warner Brothers. Those two states wrote checks to Legendary Pictures to film in those two states. That was at a time in Georgia when the Atlanta Symphony was locked out, and the Atlanta Symphony could have used a film underscoring job to take care of themselves while they were being locked out. In Alabama, when 42 was being filmed, the state was out of tax credit money for film, so it robbed an educational fund that was supposed to be used to pay for textbooks for students to hand over to Legendary Pictures. Hmm. And, you know, there's the company getting taxpayer dollars and then using those dollars, as corporate welfare, and then running overseas to create jobs. It's just plain wrong. And we have a campaign. We're motivating the legislators. We're motivating the U.S. Government and others to see the wrongness in that, to plug those tax loopholes, and to say, if you're going to get tax money, you ought to spend that tax money in the U.S. and not take it overseas.
Where are most films and television scored these days? I know that from what I hear in Los Angeles, there's not a lot going on in Los Angeles. I mean, there's still some things going on in Los Angeles, but not nearly as much as there were years ago. Are they going to, say, Western Europe? Are they going to Eastern Europe? Are they going to Canada? Where are they going from?
Well, there's not as much going on, but there's a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when a motion picture company goes overseas to make the movie, like all the James Bond movies were always made in Europe.
Sure.
They can certainly score those movies overseas. They weren't made here. Sometimes, occasionally, they'll come here to score. But no one has a problem when, you know, a foreign motion picture is made in a foreign country and is scored in a foreign country. But, you know, back to the issue of recording. The recording business is different now than it was, and there are fewer movies being made. Of the top 100 movies, 70% of them are AFM movies. The other percentages of the top 100 movies, I'm sorry, about 70% are AFM. There are probably 17% that are done overseas, and the rest of them are just done dark here in the U.S. somewhere. Might be, done in a
midnight
in a jingle shop in Miami somewhere, or who knows, you know.
Yeah, right.
But the majority of the U.S. films that are done AFM. But you have the scoring is different. It's done far more efficiently.
And you have the use of so much recorded music today, so that, you know, where it might take a couple of days or 3 days to score a film or a week, it's far less because you're doing less music.
Well, you hit the nail on the head there. The amount of scoring that's done is less because there are more recordings that are being licensed in, And let's say, for example, and everyone's gone to the movies, and then
if you sit through the credits, you're going to see a whole long list of previous recorded material.
Or as the movie opens, all of a sudden it opens underneath a Sly and the Family Stone tune or something from Motown. Yeah. Well, all that stuff gets licensed in, but our musicians continue to get paid for that. So, yeah. The new employment for that is less, while the licensing is more. So there are different ways of doing it. But the grand spectacular film score, I'll just take one. In particular, one I saw recently was the film Noah. Noah was of course, everybody knows the story of Noah. Without going into that, Russell Crowe was the star. They scored that in New York, and they scored it. I think it took 2 weeks to score it. But, that's the big, Hollywood spectacular, where you have a big elaborate score. Some of the, science fiction movies, maybe more sound effects than they are score. Of course, they have score, orchestral score. But they have more, sound effect stuff that's included, which is also scoring too. You may have a percussionist and a flutist and a cellist or something like that and a guitar, that would be used for sound effects rather mm-hmm. than the elaborate score. Mm. So it is different. And that's why we want to be more vigilant when U.S. taxpayer money is creating corporate welfare for these companies.
Subsidizing the films as they're being made, so why not include that on the last part of it, which is creating the film score?
Yeah, so we want the taxpayer money. If taxpayer money is involved in the score, or in the film production, we want the jobs for everything to stay here. And that includes not just the underscore for the soundtrack, but jobs that are being outsourced in special effects. Those are being outsourced all over the place. In the foreign subtitles, and the movie business is big all over the world. It's going to be bigger globally than
it's one
it
of our
here.
Biggest exports, really.
Exactly. Which brings me to another issue, which we're on big time, is the fact that we have a performance rights campaign that's fixing to gear up. There'll be a new bill in Congress. In a week or so, there'll be a bill to plug up the copyright loophole on pre-72 recordings. Because the performance rights digitally are not being paid on recordings that were pre-72. Now, you as a young man, I know that you probably aren't that familiar with pre-72 recordings, are you, Rich?
I know a few.
Rich
yes.
is admitting to his age here. I'm an old Woodstock generation guy myself. So, we're going to try to plug that loophole in Congress so that we get the digital rights paid for pre-72 recordings. But also, too, we're going to be moving very hard to cover analog and terrestrial broadcasting, like
radio.
You and I are talking about right now. We're actually on the radio with some loopholes for the small broadcasters and educational broadcasters. But the problem that, you just said, you're just talking about how we export our entertainment worldwide. And I was at the Beijing Convention on Audiovisual Performers 2 years ago. Where we enacted a treaty, an AV treaty, and we're already starting to receive money now from countries on AV rights that have been created. And that goes back to the people who score the film or whose records were used in a film worldwide, collect money, and then we distribute it through the AFM and SAG-AFTRA fund. But as I was in the cab going to the hotel, and the cab driver couldn't speak English, and I had this little piece of paper that I flashed at him so he could see it in Chinese and understand where to go. He still didn't understand where to go, and he pulled over to ask another Chinese cab driver, where he was supposed to go, to have the other cab driver read the piece of paper that I had. He had turned his radio down to talk to the other cab driver. Well, you know who was on the radio? It was Michael Jackson. Same thing when I was in Rome the other day, doing the same thing, over there looking out for our rights internationally. Cab driver from the airport to downtown in Rome, there was a little Michael Jackson medley on the radio. We currently don't get paid our digital performance rights in many parts of the world because we don't have the same rights here in this country on the analog situation. And so countries around the world consume our music and they collect rights that would normally be payable to us, but they keep it and we don't get it. Because we don't have that terrestrial analog right here. And they say, your country's not treating us appropriately, And until your country does, then we're not going to pay you.
What's the prospects of getting something like this through Congress?
Well, this year it's not going to be, I think they're more concerned about being elected this
right.
year. But I think next year we'll have a good shot at it.
My guest today is Ray Hare, president of the American Federation of Musicians, who was in Tulsa for the Southern Conference this past weekend. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to ask about one area, the plight of American orchestras. Mm-hmm. You have labor trouble in practically last I've heard it, it's the Met. This is under threat now, the Metropolitan
right.
Opera Orchestra. But,
I'll
Detroit,
be sitting at the table there.
Detroit, Minnesota, you mentioned mm-hmm. Atlanta earlier. Nearly all of the orchestras are having labor trouble. And it's this situation where the orchestra boards are wanting to cut back on salaries for the most part. It's always cutbacks that are at the issue. It's not about the growth of the orchestras and the growth of salaries. But when you go to orchestra concerts, usually you can get seats the day of. This is one of the facts of life. And I sort of think of that athlete thing where you have the top orchestras are making well over $100,000. How do you engender sympathy from the average working person when they hear those salaries and when an orchestra walks off?
Well, the growth and the economic take home, for orchestra musicians, it goes back to the mid-70s. And I'll just say this. In the mid-70s, I was out working the most exciting places in Dallas-Fort Worth with my own bands, and I will admit here freely, even over the radio. I mean, I had a super duper band. We worked the Playboy Club. We'd do 2 weeks at the Playboy Club and 2 weeks at the other popular lounges around Southern Methodist University and thereabouts, and we made a good living. Week in, a week out. And, it was only then that the orchestras were beginning to, come together and exert pressure, with their boards to move the salaries up. I mean, you go back to the 60s and the early 70s, and you didn't see, that kind of compensation for orchestral musicians. I mean, you were going to see a better living to be made and more potential to really make a lot of money as a popular musician, as a popular recording artist, as a musician who was doing cover band stuff, and then writing songs and putting bands together to do those, and then breaking out into a recording career. But as there were a number of strikes in the 70s and into the 80s, and I can remember when the Dallas Symphony went on strike in 1975. The Dallas Symphony was out doing things like playing the halftime or the pregame show and the halftime activities for the Dallas Cowboys back in the 60s and then into the 70s before they went to Texas Stadium. I know we got some Cowboys fans
yeah.
out there. And, there were a number of job actions all across the country that improved the livelihood for our orchestral musicians. And that trend, went through the 70s, it went into the 80s, and went into the 90s. And really for 30 years, there was a great track going up on what orchestral musicians were getting for what they were doing. And I was part of the group at the union that bargained those things up. I mean, Fort Worth Symphony went from I can remember, it seems like in 1983, my first orchestra negotiation in Fort Worth, seemed like that we had 35 full-time musicians down there in the Fort Worth Symphony. The rest of them were contracted on a per-service basis. There were 36 weeks of work, and it seemed like to me the annual salary was somewhere, in the teens, somewhere between $15,000, $16,000, $17,000, $18,000 a year. When I left Dallas Fort Worth, later on to become the International President of the Musicians Union, we had a 52-week orchestra in Fort Worth, and the base annual salary down there was $64,000 a year, and there were 50. Seemed like it was about six. There were 63 musicians under full-time pay, and there were another 9 musicians who were part-time. So they went from, you know, in the teens, 35 people making in the teens.
Yeah, that's flying in the face of income stagnation.
Right, to 63 people making $64,000 a year, plus 9 people who were part-time. Back in the early days, it was 35 people full-time and, you know, 42 people part-time. So I use that as an example to show you the kind of growth that occurred, you know, for orchestral musicians. And, you know, Fort Worth wasn't an isolated example. In Dallas, you know, and great halls were built. There was a great hall built in Fort Worth, a great hall built in Dallas, the Morton H. Meyerson Center, that the Perot family, had such a hand in. And, you know, I bargained that contract as well down there at the Dallas Symphony. And that you know, I remember what we did in 2005 to get the salary up there up to $90,000 a year. But since 2005, and that was 80 or 90 musicians under contract for $90,000 a year. And that was the entry-level wage. And, you know, on top of that, you've got health care, you've got pension. But, you know, the money was there to do it. And then you had, you know, 9/11, which put a damper on quite a bit of things economically. Then you had the fallout financially of the world financial system in 2008. And with all of that, plus the atmosphere, the attitudes towards unions, the board members and the money people on these orchestra boards began to understand that, you know, if we move against the orchestra musicians very aggressively, we don't look so bad nowadays. We don't look so bad because of the world economic climate, the anti-union attitude, the adverse decisions from the National Labor Relations Board that since the late 1970s have been terrible. They've been anti-worker all the way around. So wherever the employers sense that they can reduce their obligation to the employees and then keep more for themselves, they're going to do it.
Well, we appreciate your
time. But, you know, people can't live without music.
Yeah.
They have to have it. And we have to play it.
Well, Rafe Hare, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Raymond Hare is the international president of the American Federation of Musicians, the United States and Canada. He was in Tulsa as a part of the AFM's Southern Conference. I spoke with him while he was here. Well, this past weekend, KWGS, the University of Tulsa, Tulsa's broadcast and arts community, lost one of our colleagues, supporters, and mentors with the death of Edward Dumit. He was 85 years old. You can still hear his resonant baritone each hour as the official voice of KWGS and KWTU, and has served the stations in virtually every capacity during the station's history, first as a student, then as an advisor, as a station manager for many years, then as a program director, an arts producer, and the first co-host of this program in 1992 and 93. But Mr. Dumit, as we called him, his impact will be felt far beyond these walls. Edward was a mentor to 40 years worth of broadcasting professionals in Tulsa and around the country. As a University of Tulsa professor, he offered diction help to scores of actors and performers and a couple of Miss Americas along the way. He authored several books, including co-authoring The Announcer's Handbook and Say It Right. And he was also a passionate supporter and participant in Tulsa's cultural community, hosting countless broadcasts of symphony, chamber music, and opera programs with long relationships with the Tulsa Philharmonic, the Tulsa Opera, and the OK Mozart Festival. Edward won many awards during his career, including the Oklahoma Governor's Arts Award in 1993. He was in the inaugural class of the Tulsa Radio Icons from the Tulsa Press Club and is in the University of Tulsa's Communication Hall of Fame. But beyond all the awards and the accolades, he was a kind, gentle, and witty man and will be greatly missed. That's Studio Tulsa for today. I'm Rich Fisher.